From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nowadays, it's all on our smartphones, our social media, our banking, our search history, our communications. They're our computers within reach for many at all times. If you're arrested, should they be in reach right there for the police with no search warrant? Police say they've got to get to those phones. No warrant required. Privacy advocates say that's too much. Now it's before the Supreme Court. What they decide will help to define our Fourth Amendment rights for the digital age. This hour on Point, search, seizure, and cell phones. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Where would you draw the line here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. In a moment, we'll hear from legal experts on both sides of the issue and from police on the ground. Joining me first from New York is Jacob Gershman, reporter for the Wall Street Journal covering law, lead writer for the journal's law blog. Jacob Gershman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much for joining us on this day when the court is looking directly at this. Jacob, could you just give us a thumbnail of the two cases that have brought this before the court?
Well, the two cases are pretty similar, but they're going to be separate arguments. One involves a gang shooting. Another one involves a drug bust, and they both involve evidence that was collected from the suspect's phones. The courts ruled differently leading up to the Supreme Court cases right now, but they both have this common thread of what. Police can, how much they can search from a suspect's phone, a suspect who is arrested, how much information can they go through in someone's phone. And so we may see two, but I think it could be, I guess, cobbled together in a potentially new precedent.
We've got two cases then, one in San Diego, one in Boston. What was the key information that police got from the smartphone in San Diego that made them so keen on being able to keep that and use it in conviction in sentencing?
Well, in one case you had a photo of a car that was linked to a shooting, and so that photo was instrumental in mm-hmm. leading to the suspect's conviction.
And more there with gang affiliations indicated, I guess, by associations on that phone.
Yes, and in the other one, it was basically the phone goes off and the police officer sees who's calling, and this is the drug bust, and
in Boston.
They lead the call log leads them to a home where they collect more evidence, and that also leads to a conviction.
What's the framework for looking at this? It's the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable search and seizures. Part of it there. What's the court's or our legal system's view of the telephone being in general?
Well. So back in the late 60s and early 70s, the court in two cases basically carved out an exception to an unreasonable search and seizure, an exception to a warrantless search at the time of an arrest. And what they said was that because there's a need to preserve evidence and to protect the safety of the officer who is arresting the suspect, then it's okay to go through the suspect's pockets or search whatever the person may be holding on them. It could be a bag, it could be their wallet, it could be an address book, but that was deemed okay.
They could search, and this is 1969, I think the case
the first one was in 69, and the other one I think was in 73 or in the early 70s, just a few years later.
The first one saying they could search the body of the person and the, quote, area into which he might reach, incident to arrest here, without a warrant.
Yes. And when the cell phone cases first came up, the judges, for the most part, drew a parallel between a call log or you know, an address book and a call log, the digital and the physical. And this is when phones were flip phones and were less sophisticated, and it wasn't as much of a leap. So now with smartphones basically capable of storing a gargantuan amount of information, much of it, you know, dealing with somebody with the most intimate details of somebody's life, as you said, a digital record of their lives. You know, some people think that's a game changer, and that at this point, the Supreme Court should take a step back and look anew at what is reasonable in this situation.
So you might look at this. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals did. They said no thanks to this. They said searching a person's cell phone is like searching his home desk, computer, bank vault, and medicine cabinet all at once. And you could probably add a lot more in there if you like. I mean, at one level, it looks like an easy call, Jacob. There's so much on that cell phone. How could you possibly, under the rubric of, you know, against unreasonable search and seizure, open that up? Is this a slam dunk?
Well, it's actually a good point that side makes. It's you know, if you're being literal about it, if you're saying that a container is a container, a bag is the same thing as a phone. It contains, whether it's a physical object or data, it contains something. Well, if you take it to the next step, then you're really, a phone is really containing your library or your office. It would be the equivalent of holding all of that on you when you're walking around, which is kind of an absurd proposition.
Many of us every day.
Yeah, and or if it's like if you were carrying a laptop with you. Mm-hmm. At this point, what is the difference between a laptop and a smartphone? Based, you know, in terms of what it can store and what it can do, there's not that much difference, and there's. And courts have treated laptops differently than phones, so it's a very tricky question. And again, what the justices might be thinking about is where to draw the line. And there's many different ways that they could go about doing that.
Like what? I mean, you either are in the phone or you're not. What are the tricky ways you could draw a line through smartphone?
Well, they could say some types of information is okay to search. The more superficial information, that could be call logs or I guess even text messages. But documents or video or photographs would be off limits. They could. I guess this would be a lower bar. They could say that the police officer making the arrest would have to make a determination that it's likely that the phone contains evidence related to the crime. So if the police officer doesn't think that's a possibility, then you wouldn't do the search. But if it's a strong possibility, then you would. Another could be whatever is readily visible when you look at the phone. Another could be what you can access if it's turned off, or as opposed to, you know, what you can access when it's connected.
12 million arrests a year in the United States, many of them for misdemeanors. And in that circumstance, it's hard to imagine all the information on a cell phone laid bare before a police officer. But it has been to this point. Now the Supreme Court has it right on its table. Jacob Gershman with The Wall Street Journal, thanks for bringing us in here. Very much appreciate your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Let's bring in now Adam Gershowitz. He's professor of law at William & Mary Law School, specializing in criminal and procedure law, author of The Wire, Crime Law and Policy. Adam Gershowitz, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Salt Lake City, Utah, Kevin Boyle is here, general counsel for the International Union of Police Associations, AFL-CIO. Kevin Boyle, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
You would like to give the police pretty free rein to get into that smartphone at the time of arrest and see what's there. Why, Mr. Boyle?
Well, I think it's a little more. I think it's a little more nuanced than that. The first thing I want to point out. I know it's probably obvious, but police officers, law enforcement officers, are sworn to uphold the Constitution, and they live in society like we all do. So they have the same concerns in a lot of cases, and in all cases, as everyone else does. But there are instances at the scene of the crime where getting the information right away is very important, not only to solving a crime or preventing another crime, but also for officer safety. So being able to look at what's on that cell phone, at least from an upper level, from at least at certain things, call logs or contact lists, is very important.
Adam Gershowitz, is the whole range of options on the table here before the court, you know, unlimited capacity to get in there by a police officer at time of arrest versus something more constrained? Is that all open here?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the court could decide to stick with its earlier precedent, the cases that Jacob had suggested dating back to the late 60s and early 70s, which would give the police free range to search pretty much everything. They could also take a half measure where they try to link the search to the crime of arrest, the reason that the arrest is for, or they could ban these searches altogether and advocate or accept a rule that said we'll allow the police to seize the phone without a warrant, but not to look inside of the contents until they've procured a warrant from a judge or a magistrate.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Constitution's guarantee against unreasonable search and seizure in the digital age, the Supreme Court, and our cell phones. At the time of arrest, should they be a free open game for search by the police, or should they need a warrant? It's before the court in two cases today. Adam Gershowitz is with us, professor of criminal and procedure law at William & Mary Law School, joins us from Orlando. And from Salt Lake City, Kevin Boyle, general counsel for the International Union of Police Associations, AFL-CIO. Adam, Kevin, some questions here from listeners online about, you know, where things stand currently. Here, Benjamin asks, what's the current rule for searching laptops when somebody's arrested? Adam, what's if I'm in my car, I'm speeding, or something worse, I'm pulled over, there's a laptop there, can police search that without a warrant?
Well, there's been actually very few searches of laptops that have resulted in judicial opinions at this point. And the other interesting thing is that the Fourth Amendment doctrine here, not surprisingly, is a huge, huge mess. So in the hypothetical that you posed, the answer may very well depend on whether the laptop is in the back of a car, in which case it could be searched under an entirely different exception under the automobile exception. If it's on your person that you're carrying it around, there's a strong argument that that would not come under the search incident to arrest doctrine, but I don't think the law there is actually very clear at this point. A lot of these cases, hundreds of them, have involved cell phones. There's very, very few that have involved laptops at this point.
It's kind of wild that that would be the case, given how many laptops are out there and how portable they are at this point. Kevin, another question from listeners about passwords. Let's say access to my smartphone is password protected. Can they currently say, hey, buddy, you're under arrest, give us the password to your phone?
I've talked to a lot of our members about what they do actually out in the field, and that's not really something that comes up. In many cases, what they might do is take a look at the call logs or the contact list on the phone and then secure it.
But let's say they can't even get to that without a password right up front. Are they entitled to say, open your phone for me, give me your password?
I don't believe that that would happen out in the field. I do not think that that's something that that police officers can ask.
Adam Gershowitz, a lot of things happen out in the field. What about that?
Yeah, I think the password question is also unresolved at this point. But I think, and I've written an article suggesting this, I think it's actually quite clear that the police would be allowed to break the password if they are able to figure out how to do that.
Can they ask you for it and expect you to deliver it?
I missed the last part of the question. But
if you're under arrest, can they say, give us your password? We want to look at your cell phone. Is that current practice?
Well, to demand the password would actually raise Fifth Amendment questions about self-incrimination. But it's actually quite easy to break a password on an iPhone, for instance. It's only a four-digit code. There's a whole lot of 12- and 13-year-old boys and girls around the country who are quite good at that, actually. And you can find videos on YouTube that will explain it to you, how to have that done. Police are allowed, when they search an object incident to arrest, to break open a locked container to do that. So I don't see any reason why they would not also be able to break the password if they were able to do that. Demanding actual access to it by the person explaining what the password is would be much more complicated of a legal question because it would raise Fifth Amendment questions about self-incrimination.
Kevin, in the consideration of this case, we've heard lots of reports about sophisticated criminals who, if one of their, let's say, gang gets arrested, would direct their criminal IT department at the cell phone, maybe even erase its contents from a distance. Is that for real?
Well, you know, I was talking to a police officer last night about that, and his opinion of the intelligence of many criminals is not very high. So I don't think that you've got that level of sophistication in most cases. Maybe some kind of cartel out there that's really well organized, but I don't think the average level street crime is going to have an IT department that's able to do that. No one that I've talked to has ever heard of a remote shutdown or wipe of a cell phone.
But Adam Gershowitz, that appears to be part of the conversation here, whether police would need to hustle those phones into a special bag that wouldn't allow signals in and out so they can protect them. Is that an issue that's going to be considered in this case before the court, Adam?
Yes, and I think there's a good argument that the police really do have a reasonable concern here that the evidence in a phone could be wiped. If you think about how these cases have arisen over the years, it's only about 1993 that we started dealing with pagers and searches of pagers, and think how far we've come over the last decade. I don't think it's inconceivable to give the police the benefit of the doubt that there really may be in the near future the risk of wiping or destruction of evidence, but that risk can really be alleviated simply by placing it in an aluminum-lined bag, which is called a Faraday bag,
mm-hmm.
or really just wrapping it in aluminum foil, the kind of thing that you wrap up your lunch in to take to school.
But we heard police, I think, this morning from in Nina Totenberg's report saying, wow, you know, you pull that phone out of that bag for 2 seconds to check its contents and some evil genius is going to wipe it clean. You don't fear that, Adam. I think we got a problem with the line there. Let's go to Jason in Millbrook, Alabama. Jason, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you think, Jason?
Well, first off, I'm a 17-year vet law enforcement officer, and I have seen a great deal of change in this digital age. The first thing I want to say is I do not believe that the cell phones would fall under the Terry pad of Terry versus Ohio. I don't know if that was, I think that was mentioned earlier about wingspan type search and stuff. I definitely do not believe that would fall under that. The second thing, you know, officers, I believe officers can get around this, even if consent's not given by the arrestee, and without a warrant. However, if I go to a residence for a noise complaint,
okay,
and while I'm at that residence, I see incriminating evidence of drugs and such.
Yes.
In order for me to go through that entire house to search for that, you know, I am allowed, Supreme Court has upheld that the house can be secured until I, you know, secure a warrant on probable cause and articulate, you know, what I will be looking for.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, I believe that that will be the route that we will see after the decision from the Supreme Court. I believe they will uphold that, indeed, a cell phone is protected under privacy. But police officers, if they can articulate and they have the probable cause to go forward and articulate to what they're looking for in the phone, such as contacts, text messages between criminals, photographs that would be incriminating for a certain case, then I believe they could hold that phone and secure that phone just as they would a house, and then you know, achieve the warrant, and then they'll have access to the entire phone. And that way, I believe it would be a stronger use as evidence in the case, and also, you know, it would be a tool for officers to have at their disposal as opposed to getting consent. You know, someone could always give consent.
Yeah,
I do. I'm sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
No. Well, I just wanted to get Kevin Boyle in on this. You're a solid thinker on this, and Kevin, okay, secure it if you must as a police officer. You know, secure it, hold it, but get a warrant before you really go in there. Show probable cause.
Well, I do think that that's, by and large, the practice that's happening right now, and I agree with that. And, you know, we're talking about technology and how technology is speeding along. I think one of the things we have to look at is there a way to actually speed up the warrant process? Because in many instances right now, you have to type up the warrant and deliver it down to the courthouse or whatever judge or magistrate is covering, if it's at night. And many states are looking at ways to speed that up, maybe do it digitally or do it over the phone, so that the time frame between the actual arrest and the ability to look at that phone is reduced.
Why would speed be an issue, Kevin?
Well, I think, you know, we're talking before, in one of these cases they found it was about 2 hours before they actually went through and found some of this incriminating evidence. And maybe digging farther down into the cell phone would enable the officer to discover some important information rather than just that call log or contact list. So I think that speed is important, especially to stop a developing crime, catch a suspect that might be leaving the jurisdiction. So time's always important.
Let's go to Harry. Jason, thank you very much for your call. Harry in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, hello. I'm against the police having access to my cell phone without very diligent, proper oversight from the courts. Second,
yes, sir.
I also am against people using their cell phones when they're out driving, and if there's an accident or they cause the accident, how can I show and prove that the other guy was on the phone talking or even texting or doing something, playing with the cell phone at the time of the accident?
That's interesting, Harry, and that's come up in repeated cases I've seen. Adam Gershowitz, what about that? The access when there's an accident, many people texting and driving these days, and we've heard of those phones being brought into cases to prove that they were distracted while they were driving. Does that come into this picture at all?
I'm not sure it comes in directly to this case. It is tangentially related. A lot of states have laws that forbid texting while driving, but I think most people would be surprised at how loose those laws are. In most places, the fine for texting while driving is $20, $50, maybe $75. And the laws are so old at this point that they only deal with very certain functions of the phone. And so people today are making a lot of arguments successfully. Well, I wasn't texting while driving. I was calling. I was looking at the map function on my phone, all of which are actually permissible in a number of states. Now, if someone causes an accident while texting, there would certainly be evidence of recklessness, which would be admissible. And I think you'd have to go to the phone company and subpoena records to demonstrate the timing of messages being sent or calls being made, both of which have been done at this point. And so it is a factor in civil litigation today.
Let me bring Sheriff Grady Judd into our conversation right now. He's not far from you there in Florida, Adam Gershowitz. Sheriff Judd is sheriff of Polk County, Florida, includes Lakeland, Florida, just outside Tampa, Orlando, that area. He's worked as the sheriff there since 1972, first in the office, first elected sheriff in 2004. Sheriff Grady Judd, we've spoken before. Thank you for joining us again today.
How are you doing today?
Well, the argument, one of the arguments, one side before the court, or two, because there's two cases here, is that a warrant ought to be required to get into someone's cell phone when they're arrested. What do you think of that as an active sheriff?
Do you know there are a couple of issues that we have to deal with? First off, the courts have got to solidify a divided courts all over the country. And a search warrant normally is not a problem in some jurisdiction, and it's an overwhelming problem in other jurisdictions. Now, for example, in my jurisdiction, I can get a search warrant 24 hours a day. So the question is, for those communities that can't, it can be problematic. But it goes back to where do you see the cell phone? If someone's carrying the cell phone on their person, mm-hmm. and we stop a car, Gantt clearly says that, you know, we can search their immediate surroundings, whatever is within arm's length, and there's some requirements. So the question is, why shouldn't we be able to search the cell phone itself under that circumstance?
But that's exactly the question here, isn't it? Because a cell phone is not like a pistol or an address book with a dozen addresses in it. This could have nearly the entire record of a person's life. That's the issue that's being put before the Supreme Court. I mean, you know the Fourth Amendment and our presumed guarantees of privacy. Do you see the risk there to American privacy? If you can, because it's in everybody's pocket these days, they're arrested, you go in, you've got everything.
Well, what you carry in your cell phone is certainly up to you. If you want to carry your life history in there, that's a personal decision. But if you're going to violate the law, I would suggest that you don't carry your personal history in your cell phone if you don't want the government ultimately to have access to it. If you carried your personal history in your briefcase in the front seat of your car, and we made that same arrest under the appropriate circumstances, we could seize your briefcase full of your life's history. So what we have here, we have one side of the coin saying, hey, we've got this great technology, and because it holds a whole lot of information, now the government shouldn't have the rights that they've always been guaranteed under the law.
Professor Gershowitz, how about it? Sheriff Judd says, look, if your briefcase was there, they could look through all that. The cell phone, if it's in reach, how is it different?
Well, he's right about the location of the items. The problem, of course, is the Fourth Amendment applies not just to people engaged in criminal activity. It applies to you and me and everyone else. And so in many instances, police may then search your cell phone and find there's no evidence of criminal activity, but they still may have gone through very intimate information about your health records, your banking information, photographs of you and your family, or something more embarrassing than that. And so the comparison to the briefcase is right in terms of the location, but it's not quite true, I think, today in terms of the quantity of information that's held. And the cases about the briefcase that have existed for a long, long time, for almost half a century at this point, were decided in an era where no one could have possibly conceptualized that basically the entire equivalent of your home, all of your personal information, is now being carried around with you. And so when the court established those precedents, they never could have possibly thought of this idea. And so it is right, I think, for the court to reconsider the issue in light of the fact that circumstances have changed.
Jeannie in Camden, South Carolina is calling. Hi, Jeannie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you think?
My question is that you aren't necessarily guilty because you're arrested.
Quite right.
What if it's just for drunk driving or reckless driving or that circumstances? Would it apply for that? Or does it have to be actual targeted? It makes sense if it's an ongoing investigation where you're targeting somebody, then maybe you could have pre-warrant, you know that you're going to be getting them, then absolutely you should be able to search a cell phone.
Jeannie, let us pick it up. My time is short before the break, but I'm interested in that line of thinking. Adam Gershowitz, does the nature of the crime behind the arrest matter, or the point in an investigation should or does that matter?
At this point, I don't think either one of them is the issue. The nature of the crime under existing precedent doesn't matter one bit, whether you're arrested for drunk driving, for failure to wear a seatbelt, which is actually an arrestable offense in a number of places in the country, mm-hmm. or for rape, arson, and murder. Current precedent doesn't draw any distinction. Now, I think the sheriff would tell you, and I would agree with this, that when police are approaching somebody who they suspect may be involved in criminal activity, the situation is often very fluid, and they may not know at that moment whether they're dealing with a harmless individual who's violated a minor misdemeanor offense or somebody who could have a situation that grows into a much more serious felony. And so with the situation being fluid, it's actually very tough for the police to know what kind of situation they're dealing with sometimes, which is why the court has tried to adopt a bright-line rule here. There's, as you mentioned, 13 million arrests in the United States every year. The brighter and clearer the rule is for the police, the easier it is to apply in all of these cases. But that doesn't mean necessarily that it should have to be an always search bright-line rule. The court could just as easily adopt a rule that says we're never allowed to search the cell phone. We should wrap the phone in aluminum foil or a bag and hold on to it secure until we can go get a warrant.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Constitution's guarantee against unreasonable search and seizure in the digital age. The Supreme Court and our cell phones, a couple of cases before the court today that will decide at the time of arrest, can police just search those phones without a search warrant? Adam Gershowitz is with us from the professor of law at William & Mary Law School. Sheriff Grady Judd is with us, sheriff of Polk County, Florida, down in the Tampa, Orlando area. A lot of experience in law enforcement. And Kevin Boyle is with us from Salt Lake City, general counsel for the International Union of Police Associations, AFL-CIO. Lots of questions online. We'll come to them as well. I mean, here's just one comment from a listener in Saudi Arabia. Arabia. We said, should they be able to search and seize the cell phone? He says, well, that's what happens in Saudi Arabia. Your cell phone is searched right away when you're arrested. I don't know if we want to make that our model, but it happens a lot in the U.S. right now as well. Decatur, Illinois, Michael is calling. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. As a younger member of our society, I do a lot on my phone.
Yeah.
With all that I do on my phone and all that everybody else does on their phone, I'm worried about similar cases to that happening 50 years ago where you're searched and then you self-incriminate yourself by having other illegal documents or, so to speak, on your phone.
We see the risk, so put yourself in the police shoes or the high court shoes. Where would you draw the line, Michael?
I'm not sure. Maybe taking separations between a case-by-case basis. Maybe if it's a car crash, maybe not do it, but maybe a drug bust, yes. It's kind of an iffy line, in my opinion.
An iffy line, and a young American there with plenty of awareness and concern about everything that could be searched and self-incrimination if that cell phone is wide open. Let me get one more right here, if I may. A lot of people talking about, well, get the search warrant and then go in there, show probable cause. Tim in Charleston, South Carolina. Tim, you're on the air.
Thanks. I thought of this issue when the police officer called and used the example of the lawful presence in the house due to a noise complaint.
Uh-huh.
The question here is, if the police are ordered to get a search warrant, what do they use for the affidavit portion of the search warrant? In the officer's example, he has a lawful presence in the house and sees things in plain view. He then uses that to go get the warrant. An example of the seizure of a phone in and of itself sitting on a police officer's patrol car seat, is no evidence of criminality at all. And so it's interesting to me what will be cited as probable cause for a warrant to search the phone. Is it simply because it was possessed by someone who was arrested? A number of issues arise.
Tim, stand by. Sheriff Judd, respond to that. I mean, a cell phone in itself, on its face, it's kind of an innocent piece of technology. There may be incriminating evidence in there, but how do you make the case for going in?
Well, Gantt versus the United States, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, says the passenger compartment may be, if it can be reached by the arrestee, can be searched. If you arrest a person, then you can go into their pockets, and you can go into their wallets. You can go into any notes they have in their pocket. So if you follow that precedent, that law that's already in place, then it should be no different for a cell phone. The challenge for the court is to determine if just because the devices of today can carry your life's history, should the police have access to that? And I can tell you quite frankly, when you dismiss the conspiracy theorist, when we search a phone pursuant to an arrest, if people's medical records are in there, if there are financial records are in there and we're not doing a theft or fraud investigation, we don't document any of that. We're there looking for child pornography. We're there looking for photographs of drugs. We're there looking for photographs of stacks of evidence or stacks of money. And in that case, we may look into your financials if you have it in the phone. But believe it or not, your average police officer and your average police agency, you know, when you take the conspiracy theorist out of there, we could care less what's in your phone if it's not criminal in nature, nor do we ever want to make it public.
Well, I mean, I'd like to believe that, but then we can see it at the same time, Sheriff Judge, just how easily it could turn into a fishing expedition, and it's just an obvious risk, isn't it?
You're absolutely right. It could turn into a fishing expedition, but once again, those bad examples are why the court has to make the decision they do. And, you know, we're going to abide with whatever the court does. But right now, believe it or not, Florida is the one that says you have to have a search warrant. California, and they're known for being much more liberal than Florida, says you don't have to have a search warrant.
What about our caller in Charleston? He says, you know, looking at Gantt, that ruling that if it's within reach in the car, you can go after it. But if you have to have a warrant, he says it may be hard for you to describe what it is that you want.
Well, and quite frankly, what the law says, if we're searching for evidence of the crime, for which he's been arrested. So I suggest to you under Gantt that if we arrested somebody for driving without a license or they were DUI, I'm not sure we would have a right to search the phone because nothing in that phone would be of particular interest to a DUI arrest.
Adam,
but at the same time, we arrest them for a fraudulent activity.
Adam Gershowitz, if you could, Gantt here, this case and what's within reach, within the car at the time of arrest, is that on the line in the cases the court's hearing?
Yes, it is. So the sheriff is right that the court changed the law in 2009 in a case called Arizona versus Gantt. And what they did is in that case it said when they search the inside passenger compartment of the car, primarily the only way they get to do that is if they have reason to believe evidence related to the crime that they're arresting the person for could be found inside the vehicle. And so you might say, oh, well, there'd be no evidence in a cell phone for a DWI arrest. And I think that's right today in 2014. I think that will no longer be correct in 2016 or 17. You know, in a couple of years, you see people in Starbucks sometimes paying for their drinks with an electronic payment on their cell phone. And
sure,
there are apps now for electronic payments that record pretty much everything you purchase. It's called Google Wallet or Square Wallet.
Yep.
Once those become commonplace, there would be a record on your phone of where you went to the bar, what you bought there, how long you stayed, what you drank, all of which would create reason to believe evidence of the crime of drunk driving would be found on the phone. And there are lots of other examples like this that as the technology advances, more and more information that could link you to even minor crimes, trespassing, your phone records exactly where you've been on your iPhone, what time you got there, what time you left. As that becomes more commonplace on smartphones, it would be very reasonable for the police to believe evidence of the crime of arrest could be found in the phone. And so that standard, if the court goes with it, will actually be not much different than basically allowing it in all cases.
But, what they're talking about here is not whether they can do it, but whether they need a search warrant to do it, right? I mean, right now they could just go after it if they chose.
Yes, I mean, the Gantt case, the sheriff is right, put some restriction on what the police can do now in searching an automobile. And so they can't just search the entire automobile any longer.
But your cell phone's probably in reach, so.
Well, no, it not only just in reach, but also they would be required under that case to demonstrate reasonable belief that evidence of the crime they're arresting the person for could actually be found in the vehicle. And so it's not quite as broad as it would be if it's just you or I walking around on the street.
Once they get into that phone, one of our listeners here, so if one uses the cloud via their cell phone, is that also open to search, Adam?
Yeah, so as the law exists, if the court adopts a rule that sticks with current precedent and says you can search incident to arrest the phone just like anything else, well, I don't see any distinction between what's in the cloud and what's on the phone because the point is that stuff could be destroyed or deleted and things in the cloud could be deleted just as quickly. The court could try to draw a distinction, and I think Jacob Gershman was discussing this at the very top of the hour,
mm-hmm,
between items that are on the phone and items that are in the cloud. But that distinction is very difficult to draw because if you think about your email account that you might have linked to your phone, as soon as you tap on the icon for your Gmail or your Hotmail or your other email, it automatically downloads messages from the cloud. And so if the court drew a distinction between what's on the cloud and what's on the phone, it would be almost impossible for them to use that distinction in a case-by-case basis because it would be very difficult to figure out what was on the cloud and what was on the phone.
Of course, there's this assertion of a race between getting information that might be helpful in the case and that information getting erased. Our listeners writing in plenty to say, you know how easy it is to erase. Paul says, let's see, I have my iPhone. I go to find my phone app, locate the phone, touch actions, and what pops up? I can erase my phone. Or another listener says, I have an Android phone. I can log into my Google account and through that access my phone, wipe its contents, no problem. William in Crescent, Oklahoma. William, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for...
What do you think, William? What's your story?
Well, when I was younger, I committed a lot of crimes and stuff, and I went to prison. I mean, I done, you know, things I shouldn't have done.
Okay.
But I believe that, you know, if you're arrested, you lose the right, you know, especially if you're caught red-handed doing something, you know, and I believe that the police should be able to search anything that's on you.
But, I mean, you know, of course, that in fact you don't lose your rights just because you're arrested. You get into a web of established law and procedure, but you still have rights. I mean, maybe there's a limit to what should be open. What do you think?
No, I think you should lose your rights. I mean, I've done a lot of stuff. Like I said, I went to prison, and, you know, and when you go to prison, you lose everything. I mean, you're told what to do. And if a person is willing to go out there and hurt somebody else, steal from them, you know, give them drugs, you know, drugs kill people, you know, and I believe that the police should have the right to be able to search your phone, your laptop, you know, anything that's within reach. Like I said, I mean, that's just my opinion.
William, I appreciate your perspective. Of course, we've got to remember, innocent until proven guilty here. Kevin Boyle, there's a caller from Oklahoma who's kind of, you know, he's been down the road and he's come around to thinking just go at it. But there are rights that don't go away at all at the time of arrest, Mr. Boyle.
No, I think the caught red-handed aspect might come into play, too. There are certain points where it's up to the person being arrested to waive those rights, too. You get your Miranda warning and you can still talk if you want to. So, that is an aspect of, you know, in any arrest situation. But I want to also join in with Professor Gershowitz about what happens at the scene of an arrest. Sometimes something that looks like it's something else, maybe fairly innocent, maybe a DUI arrest, might evolve into something else once the officer gets there and starts seeing what's happening. So it is a very fluid situation at, you know, at the scene.
But, of course, that evolution can lead to going down all kinds of trails on a cell phone as well. And who knows what's in there? Paul in Des Moines is calling. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is basically, I work in mental health. My wife works in mental health.
Yeah.
Everyone I know we work with carries around smartphones. We have client information, life plans on them. My question is, if the police take the phone and search it from us without our permission, isn't that a massive HIPAA violation?
We have so much on our persons these days. I don't know where that goes. Adam Gershowitz, I mean, with or without a search warrant, once you get in there, Paul's thinking about mental health records and medical records. Sort of no end to the questions that come up here.
Yeah, and it's not just the HIPAA questions. There's a question, for instance, among attorneys who might have information about their clients or doctors who might have about their patients. This question goes actually also to the border, where searches of smartphones and laptops occur, and all of that private information is there as well. And so, yeah, there are privacy concerns for patients, for clients, for all sorts of things, which further, I think, reiterates the reason why the court's got to be careful to allow too broad of a scope here without any restriction.
But our metaphors and examples for this tend to be physical, and now we're in this digital age. I mean, how do we get the expertise on this high court or beyond to draw good lines here that let law enforcement do what they have to do, but not run willy-nilly through all the data of our lives over maybe next to nothing in an arrest, Professor?
Yeah, it's a tough situation. The Supreme Court is a group of nine very, very smart people, but they're not the most nine technically in touch people you're ever going to find. In fact, they're fairly out of touch. This is one of those cases, I think, where the clerks hired by the justices become much more valuable. I think the justices on an everyday basis are so smart and so well-versed in the law, they could do their job without their clerks. But this is a case where the 25- or 26-year-old recent graduates of law school are actually quite valuable to the court because they can show these justices, you know, who are much older and much less in touch with these kinds of things, what's really going on in the world. And that may be one of these cases where the clerks become much more valuable than they actually are in other cases.
Sheriff Judd, you're kind of old school, and I say that with respect, but Americans have seen, you know, all kinds of electronic surveillance being done at home and around the world. I mean, they become leery when law enforcement gets into the digital realm. Do you think that, I mean, as you presumably have privacy issues yourself, concerns yourself here, do you think we've got the expertise in our law enforcement and judicial system to get in there and draw the right lines in the digital realm, Sheriff?
You know, certainly there can be abuse by a law enforcement agency or any government entity, but I can tell you on balance, we have a very professional agency. When we legally search, whether the court allows us to do that independently or whether we have to get a warrant, even with a warrant, we're going to have access to all that data. We're not the least bit interested in disclosing information on folks that may be mentally ill that we obtain from a counselor's phone. We're not interested in disclosing anything that a doctor or a lawyer has client privileges.
I mean, that's good to hear, but suddenly you're in there wandering around through all of the person's personal private information. Isn't there a temptation?
Well, you look, that's when you have to understand that that's the system. We're going to look for criminal evidence of a crime. If there's no crime, there's no foul. But there's a solution to this. Don't put that stuff on your phone if you're going to go out and be a criminal.
Yeah, I heard you before, and I hear you again on that. But boy, these days, things seem to get up on those phones in a hurry. Good idea not to be a criminal. But whoever you are, if you're arrested, there could indeed be a lot on that phone. Sheriff Grady Judd, Sheriff of Polk County, Florida. Sheriff Judd, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you very much. It was my honor to be with such a distinguished panel.
Kevin Boyle at the International Union of Police Associations in Salt Lake City. Thank you, Kevin, for joining us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And Adam Gershowitz, William & Mary Law School. Thank you, Professor.
Thanks for a great discussion.
We'll be watching the High Court. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.